From WISO, this is Filmically Perfect, a lively discussion about movies and what makes a perfect film.
Live from 91.3 WISO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, it's Filmically Perfect with J. Todd Anderson, George Willeman, and me, your host, Nikki Dakota. Indeed, madness is just about to take control here as Filmically Perfect hits the airwaves on 91.3 WYSO. Hello and welcome to this very special edition of Filmically Perfect as we get prepared to have the scary month settle in. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome via the phone lines today Nitrate Film Archivist for the Library of Congress and all-around vessel container of all things film, George Willeman. George, welcome.
Hello, Nikki Dakota.
It's pretty good. Also sitting with me in the flesh in the lovely, sunny, beautiful studios of WYSO. It is Nitrate. Not Nitrate, a storyboard artist? I think not. Pen, ink, paper, and sheer elbow grease.
I don't believe we've ever done Nitrate storyboards before.
They don't need
to make a movie then.
You heard it on Filmically Perfect. It is the storyboard artist to all the big stars, Coen Brothers for 20 years and running, plus some really cool films in between. He's our friend as well, J. Todd Anderson. J. Todd, thanks for being here.
Oh, pretty. Nikki Dakota.
It almost makes me think that there are some other films that have taken
nods. Yeah, still another take on the Frankenstein narrative here with the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
We're gathered here today to talk about this. George, what year was this film out?
1975.
Okay, so 75, and here we are, 30-plus years
Don't remind me! Stop it!
And to this day, there are people that not only have this thing memorized from beginning to end, every single aspect.
And I am not one of those people.
Actually. But they can interact with portions
they're
of the
friends.
Dialogue as well. There's so much to this. But first, let's remind all that this is not some capricious fly-by-night willy-nilly assessment of films. But there are
this one is particularly capricious, actually.
It is.
Oh, is there?
If you look up the word camp in the dictionary, you're going to find little stills from this movie. This is a perfectly campy movie, wouldn't you say, George?
It defines camp, I think, in a lot of ways.
But there are rules.
Well, you know, perfection is everywhere in movies, and this just happens to fill the bill because it creates the world it exists in. Oh, we got to have those.
There we go.
Yeah, Rocky Horror Picture Show creates the world it exists in.
And it totally sustains that world.
And regardless of changes in our society, it still retains its meaning and entertainment value.
And unlike all those other low-class groups, this film is not related or relegated by any numerical system. It stands on its own 2 feet.
Boy, does it ever.
Or 3 feet, maybe.
Yeah.
My guess is that after, you know, some really terrible, you know, global warming event where the whole continent sinks somewhere, you're going to hear this thing.
So it'll be one of the first things that people come together in groups and begin, when the arts get reinstated, they'll be performing
when they
Rocky
dig up
picture
in our
show.
History 3 million years from now, they're going to dig up this disc first. And it's gonna, this is what's going to happen.
This is what Earth was like in the 20th century.
This is how they behave. No wonder the place melted down.
It's just taken on so much beyond its original the sum of its parts. It now has this whole emergent other life. But if it's possible, in a nutshell, George Willeman, can you give us a little bit of the plot of the action in this movie?
Yeah, a lot of action. The plot, such as it is about a young, very, very white American couple, Brad and Janet. Who have a flat tire and make their way back to a castle and want to use a telephone. And it
turns out a castle.
That they're
huh. And they, don't forget they do their little up with people kind of I'm in love, you're in love kind of thing, which is absolutely spectacular.
It's a musical
often
movie.
Overlooked.
Yeah, we haven't really even said out flat ride, this is a musical.
The Damn It Janet up with people kind of song.
Right. The when they get in the castle, they interrupt this celebration by this group, and it turns out the head of their group, who's also a scientist, may or may not have had something to do with their being caught in the forest. So
he's a rival scientist.
Yes. He shows them this creature that he's built, this sort of bodybuilder with blonde hair, who is also going to be like his love slave, and they find that they are pretty much trapped in this house now, and to their surprise, they are visited by a teacher friend of theirs who is bound in a wheelchair, who is looking for his nephew, who had previously been the head of the Transylvanians' love slave, who he kills with a pickaxe.
This movie is not dissimilar to Louis Buñuel's Exterminating Angel, folks. For those of you who think we have sold out, just think about that movie when you're comparing this movie. Exterminating Angel, okay, for you really critical thinkers out there.
Right, and these characters end up sort of trapped in this world that has been created and actually eventually sort of end up giving in to the constant barrage of sensuality that is offered to them. To the point that by the end of the movie, they're all destroyed by it.
But it's because the music's so good. Those four-bar hooks get them, man, and they just go for it.
The music is notable. George, do you know anything about the backstory on who did the music? Some of it's really catchy.
Well, yeah, actually,
the little humpback guy in the movie. He's the man.
Richard O'Brien, who plays Riff Raff, the butler, basically, the kind of long, scraggly-haired butler.
He's supposed to be the humpback in the narrative.
The hunchback, yeah. He wrote this as a stage show back in the early 70s, and it was quite a hit in London, and Lou Adler, who's the producer of the film, brought it over to America and convinced 20th Century Fox to turn it into a movie.
Now, the director in this show was Jim Sharman, and he had his roots with the Jesus Christ Superstar traveling road shows in England, and that's where he got his chops.
Oh, interesting.
And he also directed a stage show. In fact, this is one of the few stage-to-film transformations that pretty much maintained the entire cast.
And it is pure, too.
All the main characters in the movie are played by the people who played them on stage.
It seems like once you set that role, it makes sense that, I mean, who else could step into this? It is so bizarre. I don't know if we should yet get into this extra thing before we sort of sum up the plot, but I have a very clear...
Oh,
dude,
we could spend hours summing up this plot.
I have a very clear, distinct memory that will forever be burned in my brain of the first time I saw this movie, which would have been in the 80s, the late 80s, at a mall cinema play at midnight, and I don't know whether I should even mention yet.
It seems to me that most people's early memories of this film somehow involve either getting wet or getting like bread or rice or toilet paper thrown at them, publicly humiliated up in front of a theater full of people.
Yep.
Keep in mind, folks, this is the granddaddy of midnight movies. This is the movie that really set the till, just set it going in motion for midnight movies. As it's kind of faded out, but back in the late 70s, midnight movies were really hot, and this was the granddaddy, wouldn't you say, George?
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, there were midnight movies, but this one sort of took on a life of its own. So
and
then,
it did...
from then on, there were midnight movies, and then there was Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah. It didn't really make money until it hit the midnight circuit.
Right. In fact, it was a flop. It was a huge flop when it came out. I mean, mainstream America was not ready for anything like this.
Yeah, and this is 1975, you know, so they are having a little hard... I mean, just think about the topics that they cover in this movie. Even when
there's
I remember seeing
homosexuality, there's transvestites, there's infidelity, there's
not that there's
murder.
Anything wrong with that.
No.
As Jerry Seinfeld says.
There's a lot here, and it's interesting to me that it originally was a flop. And George or J. Todd, do you know when did it make that jump? Was it originally set out that it should be an audience participation film,
no,
or did
not,
this
not
spring
at
up?
All. In fact, there were some people at Fox who were trying to figure out what to do with it. And they got this idea of trying to promote it as a midnight movie, get it out in there. And it was actually April Fool's Day, 1976. Hmm. It opened at a midnight movie at the Waverly Theater in Greenwich Village, New York. Now, where better than Greenwich Village to find acceptance for this movie?
And people still dress like that movie there to this day.
I don't know. Actually, it probably is still playing in Greenwich Village somewhere, but it played at the Waverly, and that's where the whole thing started.
You know, I remember when they were doing this live thing where they interacted with a movie, and I was working in the movie business at that time, and I was kind of enamored by the fact that these people were trying to jump into that picture.
Yep.
And you'd talk to them, and after the show, and they'd be in their costume regalia. Any other time, they would be a little bashful doing that. But, you know, they were just as bold as they could be. They'd look you dead in the eye. Yes, I'm Frankenfurter. Yeah. yes, I'm Magenta. Yes. And I am the monster, you know. And it was always some guy who was out of shape and everything, wearing a little bikini brief, you know. Can't you go to the weightlifting store or something and get yourself a good monster for this show?
We're talking about Rocky Horror Picture Show on Filmically Perfect on 91.3 WYSO. And so it was April 1st, 1976, that this whole other life of this movie began. And I'll just tell you that the person I went with who took me, who had seen the movie many, many times, just would not tell me what to expect. And he knew full well that it was going to be mind-altering.
People had a hard time explaining this stuff because they were so involved.
He didn't want to either.
Now, when you went the first time, did he point you out as a virgin?
Yes, he did.
That's one of the big things about it. People who go for the first time, especially if they go with friends, the friends immediately point them out to the rest as virgins, and that's when they get taken up front and get publicly humiliated.
I'm telling you what.
Sort of their baptism of fire.
I will never forget it. And then the fact that I had never experienced anything of the kind, that people representing each of the different cast members, and I got the feeling that these were regulars, that this happened every, midnight showing. These same people would come and stand up against the movie screen and basically run off and on as the characters came in and out of the actual film celluloid version there and repeat the lines verbatim.
I often talk about the suits around the table and the marketing discussions and how they've never quite figured things out. But can you imagine that this wasn't even on their radar screen when they were marketing this picture? Maybe some guy stands up, hey, what if everybody dresses up and goes to the theater and acts like the characters? And you can just tell, well, yeah, sure, sit down, Phillips, and we'll move through the rest.
George,
nobody could ever dream of how these people made this movie successful.
Was it completely organic, or did they pass out scripts initially? Do you know, George?
I believe it was completely organic. It just kind of built itself.
Unbelievable. And so then when certain characters come out, you say certain things every time.
None of which we can repeat on the air.
None. None. And the movie itself is not particularly foul, potty-mouthed, is it?
I think they dropped the F-bomb once during a song.
Yeah, okay.
It's just that, but it goes by really fast.
The bizarre structure of this movie is something to always behold, how they just meander away in their narrative. And like at the end when they're in front of the RKO, it's like they make constant homage to old Hollywood musicals and a lot of King Kong and Fay Wray. But, for those of you out there who know a little bit about RKO, they were very famous for their big dazzling dance things with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. And there were always these massive pull-up crane shots that showed people dancing off the ceiling everywhere. Who did the Fred Astaire in the room dancing on the ceiling? Was that RKO, George?
No, that was actually later when he went to MGM. But
yeah.
Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers films had a lot of very groundbreaking visuals. Excuse me.
And they were big. I mean, visually.
Very, very glossy.
Big. And you can just tell that the people were enamored by this musical thing that kind of faded away. Not a lot of people talk about RKO's history in this stuff with musicals that they used to just kick out in the 30s. And I think this movie here is paying a lot of homage to that studio.
Plus, it's really smart.
Not just the RKO musicals, but also King Kong, which was their big, huge hit.
All their lyrics, and it's mentioned at least twice in this movie, isn't it?
Yeah, at least, yeah.
So it's sort of like a send-up. But then I'm telling you what, it holds up in its own right. I do have Sweet Transvestite queued up here just for a little musical interlude fun. Shall we hear a bit of that?
Brad, please. Let's get out of here.
For God's sake, keep a grip on yourself, Janet.
But it seems so unhealthy here.
It's just a party, Janet.
Well, I want to go.
Well, we can't go anywhere till I get to a phone.
Well, then ask the butler or someone.
Just a moment, Janet. We don't want to interfere with their celebrations.
This isn't the Junior Chamber of Commerce, Brad.
They're probably foreigners with ways different than our own. They may do some more folk dancing.
Look, I'm cold, I'm wet, and I'm just plain scared.
I'm here. There's nothing to worry about.
How'd you do, I? See, you've met my faithful hand in hand. He's just a little broad dying because when you knocked, he thought you were the candy man. Don't get strung out by the way I look. Don't judge a book by its cover. I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover.
I just want to say the first time that I saw this movie, about when this song hit, I was scared to death.
I tell you, when you watch Tim Curry really do it like nobody else can do it, there is a good reason for that. It's because he did it on the stage.
Well, that's
he's doing it. He hits all his numbers, and he does it with absolute perfection in this
movie.
That's
one of the big things about this movie. This is Tim Curry's movie, and he just takes – when he gets on screen, there's no one else on there. I mean, he just
mesmerizing.
Chews up this film and spits it out, and he's just – as an actor, so much in control of his part.
The thing you got to admire
Jim Sharman for is knowing that and letting him do his bit.
Whew, he sure did. You know, one of the things I really like is Barry Bostwick, who later became Mr. Made for Television.
On Spin City.
And
he is
like the alpha male sci-fi guy.
Yeah. Right.
So it's like, he's able to step out and just do his character like every alpha male sci-fi guy in the 50s. And it's okay. It fits right into this movie. It's fine. And then before Susan Sarandon became... Well, it's just not
before
as exciting.
Before she became Oscar-winning actress Susan Sarandon.
Yes.
Before she was showing her handcuffs to the camera and things like that. Mm-hmm. She was dazzling.
Yeah, she really was. And she's scantily clad.
Oh, yes, that's why we went. Oh, boy.
You know, it's funny because it seems like the actors in this were so good that they virtually got typecast. In many ways, Susan Sarandon's really the only one that sort of busted out and went on. Poor Barry, what's his name?
Barry Bostwick.
I mean, that was many years between this movie and what he eventually did.
Yeah, Tim Curry occasionally shows up as a villain, but it's always Frankenfurter.
Yeah,
you know?
He will always be that. It's almost a curse and a blessing at the same time. We're talking about Rocky Horror Picture Show on 91.3 WYSO, a movie that transcends movies. I'll say, as far as the rules go, Rule 3, this blows it out of the water that it sustains itself.
Well, not only has it sustained itself, but it's like society has caught up with it.
Ooh, yeah.
We were talking earlier about, you know, in 1975, the film didn't do well with mainstream audiences because of a lot of the taboo subjects that it shows and tackles. But our society, in quotation marks, has now sort of dipped down to the point where it's, you know, it's on a level playing field now.
It's hard to tell who's lapping who here, the movie or our culture.
Yeah.
Which one is in the lead lap? It's not unheard of. You could go anywhere and see people kind of dressed up like this on a normal basis, especially, you know, Melrose Avenue. You know, that's where it's very easy to see. But here in Ohio, you still see people, you think... You know, Rocky Horror Picture Show. When you see them,
Halloween
like
is
that.
Coming up, and you will see. I invariably will see at least one character from this movie, and sometimes even among younger children. Like I have seen Frankenfurter painted on a 6-year old. I'm serious, not
so
mine.
They can even get away with the name Frankenfurter in this movie. That's really astounding.
So, as far as the rules go, I have to say, Made in Spades on this one definitely creates the world.
Now, all you fans out there, and we know how rabid you are, we understand and we know that we can't please you guys. So we're making mistakes here because there's obviously details that we're going to move over here. And you got to tell us, you know, because we need to learn these things too. We do know one thing. It's a perfect movie. You know, you can get, you know, as snooty as you want. And, you know, you didn't say this. You didn't. But we, the film guys, and Nikki's Secret Dakota Ring knows that this is a perfect movie.
And what other show can you listen to that will speak of Rocky Horror Picture Show and To Kill a Mockingbird on the same
That's right.
level?
Last week we did Strangers on a Train. Compare that villain to this villain.
We're always interested in hearing from listeners, truly. We'd just love to get your opinions, suggestions, bones to pick, whatever you have. It's filmguys@perfectmovie.net. Please drop us a line.
We realize what a sensation this movie has created, and we understand that your passion toward this movie. So, you know, go ahead and feel free to educate us on this a little bit.
And here's a little tidbit that I wanted to throw in here. I think that the story is supposed to take place in Ohio.
Of course.
Oh, is that true?
Because I don't know. I haven't been able to confirm this, but in the scene where Brad and Janet are driving away from the wedding at the beginning, she is reading The Plain Dealer, which is like the Cleveland newspaper. And there really wouldn't be any reason for her reading that if they weren't expecting to put it in Cleveland. And I think the town of Denton is supposed to be in Ohio.
How about that? I wonder.
Don't know that right offhand.
Yeah.
If someone out there does know that or knows that not to be true, please let us know.
Well, that all feeds into this whole Dayton has something in the water thing.
You know, two things that I didn't want to let go go before we get finished is there are some strange cinematic structure in this movie, which I really like. There's not a lot of – it's very well shot, like a musical. It really has perfection in how they've set it up and shot it. It doesn't look like a lot of these pictures do. They kind of lose their momentum, kind of fall all over the place. But there's some great stuff where Meatloaf just crashes in out of nowhere.
We haven't even mentioned Meatloaf.
Yeah. And then they, of course, eat him. But after they go through his child baby album and bizarrely talk about how much they miss him, I think.
Yeah.
And then one of my favorite conventions in this picture is this record keeper guy who's supposed to be a criminologist, but he looks like a record keeper in some old town who is able to figure out, you know, who was in the Civil War and who wasn't.
And he doesn't have a neck. He has no
they
neck.
They keep cutting to him, and he pulls down these window shades, a little step to the left. It's really funny stuff.
And having him in there, I don't know if he was in the original play, but he's a perfect example of sort of their love of film, because Charles Gray, who plays the criminologist, was in several Bond movies, James Bond movies, playing a kind of stuffy character like that. So to English audiences especially, he would have been well known.
And whenever
Very serious actor.
And whenever he hits the stage, everyone shouts, boring. That's the audience. Every time.
The lack of having a neck.
And they tried to they tried to recreate the magic with this movie called The Shock Treatment not too long after, the same entourage. And he's in it.
And Shock Treatment is the perfect example of how lightning will not strike twice in the same place. Because
unless you're at the WYSO studios.
I mean, yeah, except for me.
Hey, hush up. There'll be a bolt out of the clear blue
you're
sky.
You're going to have a pull there.
Oh, my childhood memories.
When the success of Rocky Horror became so evident, you know, Fox, the suits around the table were going, well, let's try this again. So they hired all
the
people.
The famous suit scene, remember? Phillips, great, give us your idea again.
Richard O'Brien wrote it. Jim Sharman directed it. Many of the cast from the original one are in there. In fact, the Brad and Janet characters are in it. And it came out, and they pushed it as a midnight movie, and it went
boom. Boy, it tanked. I remember when it came out as a midnight movie because I was very
excited.
It's the Rocky Horror Picture Show people. And then we went in there and just kind of,
didn't throw anything.
It's the guy. Yeah, it's the same guy.
Having seen it recently, it is a really interesting film and probably needs to be reevaluated. Because
it's probably more in tune with what's going on now because everybody is ensconced by television all the time.
Right.
And this need to be in an entertainment venue. Whenever writers write anything in Hollywood, it's not a bus driver. It's not somebody who runs a crane. No. They're television writers. They're news people.
This is, George, really smartly written, isn't it? I mean, with the references and it's exceptionally well done, this guy. And had he done anything before?
Richard O'Brien?
Yeah.
And not that I'm aware of.
Amazing.
He's mainly was known as an actor and has continued on as an actor since then. I mean, he's in Flash Gordon, and he's in the movie Revolution, and, you know...
Was that Flash Gordon or Flesh Gordon?
Flash.
Okay, because there was two of those.
Yeah, there was Flesh. No, this is Ooh. Flash.
You know, and that music that he, him and Charmin put together for this show, some of the breaks in that movie, music is really good.
It's well done.
The melodies are just terrific. They're catchy. And
yeah, and they were obviously... O'Brien is obviously a major rock and roll, 50s rock and roll fan.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's got those lines and rhythms and melodies just down pat. And the songs are a lot of fun.
Yeah, they got that Leader of the Pack kind of feel when Susan Sarandon's singing. And they have that, you know, Johnny Don't Kill Him kind of feel. And
right.
Hot Rods to Hell
and
kind
Meatloaf.
Of feel.
And Meatloaf is in this movie. This was his debut?
Right.
It had to have been
long
before
was, yes.
2 out of 3 Ain't Bad and Bad Out of Hell. He was already
yeah, he was already known for those, and yeah, this was his. And he was also in the stage version.
I think that he's one of the guys who has actually beaten the rap on this picture because they don't always identify him
with
this movie, unlike Susan Sarandon
and that poor Barry guy.
Poor Barry guy.
Poor Barry. It's Filmically Perfect, and we're talking about Rocky Horror Picture Show on 91.3 WYSO, and so much more to get into about this movie, but we are running out of time. I wanted to reiterate the rules that it absolutely creates this world. Even though it's using sort of these time-worn, you know, scary, spooky story iconography, still, it just strikes out on
just
its
a stunning
very
evolution
own.
Of the
it's,
same
yeah, it's sort
theme.
Of the mixing and cross-breeding and amalgamating of all these different elements into something new.
And it definitely sets that out. It sustains
it. And one last comment. Young Frankenstein was made not too long before this. I think somewhere
Year before.
Yeah, so these are two kind of different attacks on the same narrative, Young Frankenstein, which is very literal. And this one's, well, you know, a little into the weeds. Yeah.
A little fantastic.
Yeah.
And it sustains it throughout. I'd have to say, and despite the fact that I was at risk of being hit with rice or toast or water at any time that first viewing, I was just absolutely mesmerized. I mean, I had never seen anything like it. And again, the testament to its prescribing to rule number 3, its relevance is absolutely undiminished as far as I can tell.
And that's kind of scary in some respects.
We might be able to outrun this movie.
I'm going to do a Frankenfurt account this Halloween, see how many I see walking around. No question
right.
about it. Gentlemen, we are almost out of time.
Us a line at perfectmovie.net.
Sure love to hear it. Check out all kinds of downloads available for you there. Also at iTunes and at npr.org. George Willeman, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Are we going to tip the hand for next week?
Nope.
Nope.
So stay tuned.
Another top secret movie.
Something scary, though.
Ooh, scary kids. Very scary.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO. J. Todd Anderson, thank you.
It's always my pleasure. Nikki
George,
Dakota.
See you next time around. Filmically Perfect on YSO. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Filmically Perfect with J. Todd Anderson, George Willeman, and me, your host, Nikki Dakota. Heard live every Friday after the noon news on 91.3 WYSO. The shows are also available for download from iTunes or can be streamed at www.wyso.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.